Hey, quick warning. If you have kids listening, there's some graphic language in this story that may not be appropriate for young children.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. On May 13, 2015, José de Jesús Denis Sahagún had a birthday party. It was small, just his parents and some family and friends. They celebrated on the back patio of their modest home on an isolated stretch of coast in central Mexico. José de Jesús was turning 31 years old. They were celebrating a birthday, but they were also saying goodbye. The day after the party, José would take a plane and a bus to the Mexican border and then attempt to cross the desert into the United States. His goal was to reunite with his three young children who lived in Las Vegas with their mother. José missed them terribly, and for years, he had dreamed of being near them again. But just 7 days after his party, José was dead in a U.S. immigration detention center. It was a suicide by asphyxiation, to be more precise. During the autopsy, the medical examiner found, lodged deep in José's throat, a bunched-up orange sock. José had been in the Eloy Detention Center in Arizona for just 3 days. He didn't have a history of mental illness, according to his family, and he was coming to the U.S. with a purpose, to be with his kids. So, what happened? Over the course of almost a year between 2015 and 2016, Latino USA producers Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Chavarri, and I reported on the circumstances around José's unusual death. We took trips all over the country and to Mexico, conducted dozens of interviews, and poured through government documents, all in an attempt to understand just what happened to him.
José's death at the time had been the fourth death in immigration custody nationwide in just 9 months. And in total, as of June of 2017, 172 immigrants have died while in custody of ICE. At least 8 of those were suicides.
But these deaths don't usually get much attention. And that's in part because very little news gets out from the detention center system. Many of the centers are run by private prison companies. They're located in out-of-the-way, isolated places and are notoriously difficult to get information out of.
All over the country, every day, at least 30,000 immigrants are being held in detention. They're held in places that look like prisons, but they're not prisons. They're actually meant to be temporary holding facilities. And over the years, the conditions inside these centers have drawn criticism. Yet most people know very little about how or why or where these immigrants are being held.
So we're going to bring back our two-part radio documentary that we aired last year, the story of the life and death of one immigrant detainee. We're asking the questions. Why did José de Jesús die in the custody of the U.S. government in such a strange way? And what does his death tell us about conditions inside immigration detention centers? I first heard about this story in 2015 while Marlon and I were on a reporting trip in Phoenix, Arizona.
Head west on West Elm Street toward North 19th Avenue, then turn right onto North 19th Avenue.
It was the height of summer.
What is the temperature reading right now?
It says 105 on the car. If we're to believe it, that's pretty hot.
We'd been in touch with an immigrant advocacy group called Puente, and they invited us to their office.
They invited us because something weird was going on, and it had to do with José.
We started getting letters from the Eloy Detention Center, anonymous letters, people obviously scared.
This is Francisca Porchas. She's the organizing director at Puente.
It literally happened right after his death. Right after his death. His death was on May 20th, and probably early June is when we started getting letters. And then we were like, okay, something's happening.
Puente is one of the main groups in the area that helps immigrants in detention get legal representation. So people on the inside know to contact them when something comes up.
And for a little context, the people inside detention range from those who were caught crossing the border recently to people who have been living in the U.S. for decades, and maybe their immigration status came up during a traffic stop or a workplace raid. The people that are in detention are either waiting to be deported or they're waiting for a court date to find out if they can stay.
Puente gets letters from detainees all the time, but they had never received so many letters before. Dozens. They were filled with accounts of Jose's death.
Do you have the letters here?
Let me look at my desk real quick.
That's a lot of letters.
So this is May 26th.
Mm-hmm. Here, Jose Sagun got thrown into a cell in a building, Bravo 600, like an animal. They ripped his clothes off, did not give him a mattress until around 10 p.m. All he was asking was a phone call to his family or lawyer, which never happened. He was ignored, like if he wasn't even there. He was so stressed and desperate at that point.
So he continues saying he was so stressed and desperate at that point that it pushed him to commit suicide. I believe Jose Sagun's death could have been prevented, just like other previous deaths that Eloy Detention Center has had. In other letters, several detainees wrote that they heard screaming coming from Jose's cell and believed he was beaten up by guards. One wrote that Jose was tasered and pepper sprayed, but all of them suggested that he was mistreated in detention.
It's hard to know for sure which, if any, of the accounts were firsthand and which were rumors, the kind that fly through the detention center when big things happen. But it was clear that detainees at Eloy were upset and freaked out because nobody at the detention center was telling them what was going on.
Then, a week later, some detainees said they went on a hunger strike to protest the conditions inside Eloy and to protest Jose's death.
All of it was a sign that people inside the detention center wanted to be heard.
These letters get opened before we get them. And so that's how we know there's a serious case here to investigate. If people are both putting themselves out there and putting their bodies on the line through a hunger strike. So I want there to be a real investigation.
People outside the detention center were also talking about the unusual way that Jose had died. One Democratic congressman from Tucson even called for the U.S. Department of Justice to investigate his death while activists protested.
Two recent detainees' deaths. The men started the hunger strike this morning. Then protesters say they were kept outside in the heat by guards as retaliation.
But at the time, ICE officials weren't saying much.
ICE stands for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It's the government agency that is charged with detaining and deporting immigrants. And remember that acronym, because it's going to come up a lot during this episode.
All they had said was that a man died inside the Eloy Detention Center because of unknown causes. Then, weeks later, ICE released another statement saying that a medical examiner ruled Jose's death a suicide.
Hi there. Here for an interview with Dr. Hess.
A month and a half after Jose's death, I visited Dr. Gregory Hess. Oh, yeah. He's the medical examiner from Pima County, Arizona, who performed the autopsy and reviewed Jose's file from when he was detained.
He was having what they were describing as delusional thoughts. So he was trying to bang his head against the wall, saying people were going to kill him, just kind of bizarre behavior. And he was seen by a psychologist at that facility who put him on a constant suicide watch for about a day.
This was just the second day Jose was in the detention center. He was locked up in a room, alone, with a guard watching him at all times. On the third day, the day he died, he was no longer on suicide watch and was under far less supervision.
Dr. Hez, by the way, works for the county. He's not connected to ICE or to the private company that runs the Eloy Detention Center.
Dr. Hess found a few things during the autopsy. He discovered what the autopsy report called, quote, blunt force injuries to the head. He says he doesn't know when those injuries occurred.
Whether it was during his episode of bizarre behavior, whether or not he was being restrained by corrections officials, whether or not he received that somehow crossing the border in the first place.
But he says it wasn't serious, essentially a bruise or a bump on the head.
It doesn't have anything to do with his death.
It's worth noting that Dr. Hess also read in Jose's file that he was, quote, restrained by guards, which could mean anything from being handcuffed to a more intense physical encounter.
Dr. Hess also found a white plastic handle about 4 inches long inside Jose's stomach. It appeared to be part of a toothbrush.
In my opinion, he probably consumed that toothbrush prior to the sock with the thought that if I consume this, it may kill me.
Last and most importantly, he found the sock, a bright orange, knee-high, thick prison sock.
The sock was bunched up, but essentially it was molded into the esophagus. So imagine he had to work to make that happen a little bit. So essentially that sock was distending and impacted within the esophagus. The most of the sock was occluding the entrance to the trachea. So basically what that is choking.
The autopsy found there were no drugs in Jose's system, nor any other medical problems that could have led to his death. And so, after looking at the evidence, Dr. Hess certified Jose's death a suicide by asphyxiation.
With a sock. And for many people we spoke to in the immigrant advocacy community and detainees at Eloy, the sock was suspicious, a part of the story that didn't add up to them, because it's hard to imagine that anybody could die that way.
Dr. Hess has never seen a case like this before, but he cautioned against thinking it's impossible.
It's difficult to look at people that commit suicide after the fact and then rationalize actions. Why would they not hang themselves instead? You know, I have no idea. Oftentimes, suicides are people that aren't thinking clearly because they have depression, they have psychiatric illness, they may be on substances. I have no idea what this individual's past medical history was. But I'm sure being apprehended and thrown into a facility can be stressing, and maybe that's the way he reacted.
Is there any medical possibility that this man was murdered?
No.
So what we know so far is that the medical evidence shows that Jose de Jesus died by suicide after choking on a knee sock. But we still had other questions.
What led the detention center to put Jose on suicide watch in the first place? And did the medical staff at Eloy give him the help he needed?
How could this happen just 3 days after entering the Eloy detention center? And who was Jose de Jesus? To answer that question, we had to meet the Denise Sagun family. Stay with us, no te vayas, as our story continues.
Welcome back to this special edition of Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa with producers Fernanda Echavarri and Marlon Bishop.
I'm recording. Where are we?
We are in a cab now. We just landed in Las Vegas, and we're on our way to meet the family of Jose de Jesus Sagun that has agreed to speak with us. I mean, I would hate to think, like, if something happened to my son in a foreign country, that then I'd have to come back and try to piece it together.
Yeah.
About a month and a half after the death of Jose de Jesus, we visited Las Vegas, where his brother and sister live. His parents, who live in Mexico, had flown up to Vegas to spend some time with the family after the tragedy.
Our taxi pulls into a brand new looking suburban subdivision, and we get out at a handsome ranch house.
You ready?
Yep. Jose's brother, Gabriel, opens the door and invites us in.
Gabriel Denis, soy hermano de Jesus Denis.
The family is seated at the kitchen table eating takeout. We're greeted by Jose's father, Silverio, a man with sad eyes and a big silver mustache.
He says the pain they're feeling is deep. And over the course of several hours, the family shares Jose's story.
Silverio and his wife Elisa manage a small hotel on the coast of Mexico, and their 6 kids grew up on the grounds. Jose de Jesus was the 3rd oldest. His nickname in the family was Pecoso because of his freckles.
He was the kind of brother that he used to protect us from everything or anything.
Gabriel is 5 years younger than Jose, and he looked up to his big brother.
He was kind. He have a good heart, and he was brave on his life.
When Jose de Jesus turned 19, like many young men from his little town, he decided to try his luck in the U.S. He came without papers and found work as a plumber here in Las Vegas.
He wished he can be born in this country. He always used to say that, I want to be American. I don't know why I'm born in Mexico.
Jose met a woman here, and they had three kids. But 7 years after Jose arrived in the States, his father, Silverio, became very sick with a heart condition.
His girlfriend and kids came with him to Mexico. There, they got married, but the relationship soured quickly, so his wife and kids went back to Vegas. They had legal status in the U.S., but Jose didn't.
My brother was stuck in Mexico, always trying to come back to fight for his kids, you know?
For 5 years, Jose lived with his parents in Mexico, doing odd jobs to help his dad and dreaming of reuniting with his kids. By that point, his brother and sister had moved to the U.S. He missed them a lot, too. The siblings stayed in touch on Facebook, sharing photos.
These are great photographs. So this is a photograph of Jose de Jesus doing a headstand on the... with the ocean right next to him and his little boy doing a headstand right next to him as well.
In the photos, we see a man with short, dark brown hair, light skin, and green eyes. Often, Jose wears a closely trimmed beard and a chain around his neck with a cross on it. His siblings describe him as a jokester and something of a ham.
In the years he was living back in Mexico, Jose tried to cross the border to get back into the States twice. Both times, he was caught and deported. Then, in May 2015, the day after his 31st birthday, he decided to try again.
Yo ahorita lo tengo bien presente que este...
The first step was to take a plane to get close to the border. Silverio gave Jose a lift to the airport. It was the last time he saw his son, and he remembers it very clearly. He told Jose to go with God and with the Virgin, and gave him a kiss on the forehead. I love you very much, Dad, Jose told him. And then, with a hug and a kiss, off he went.
Jose flew to Hermosillo in the north of Mexico. His family paid for the services of a coyote, as smugglers who guide immigrants across the border are known. And the smuggler took him to a safe house in Agua Prieta, just across the border from Arizona. There, they'd wait for the right moment to walk through the desert into the U.S.
And just to zoom out for a second, crossing the border is a really, really dangerous thing to do. The coyote's job is to get their people across, but there are all kinds of things that can happen. There's the natural dangers of dehydration and getting lost in the desert. And then there's the human dangers, cartels and gang members who seek to rip off migrants, corrupt cops in border towns, bad coyotes who double-cross the people they're ferrying across. For female migrants, sexual assaults are really common. Sometimes everything works out fine. Other times, it doesn't.
And in Jose's case, something goes very wrong at the border. And this is where things start to get confusing to piece together.
The day after he leaves home, Friday night, around midnight, Rosario, that's Jose's sister in Las Vegas, she gets a call from her brother.
Y me dice, Chayo, ¿estás dormida? Le dije, no, ¿qué pasó? Ya me van a pasar.
Jose tells her they're about to cross the border, earlier than expected. She says, great, call me when you get to Phoenix and we'll come pick you up.
Then, over the phone, she hears an argument between two people yelling.
Somebody mentions a comandante, a commander, but she can't really hear what they're saying.
The call drops. 5 minutes later, Jose calls her back, and now he's running and saying the smuggler wanted to kill him, and he sounds really panicked. She's never heard him sound so scared in her life. While they're on the phone, he flags down a car and offers the driver money to take him to the official border checkpoint. There, while he's still on the phone with his sister, he runs up to U.S. Border Patrol and hands himself in, saying he needs protection.
So you felt like he was going to be safe because he was in American agents' hands?
He's in good hands. That was my first thing. He was in good hands. Because after that, we can get a lawyer or do something, take him to court or whatever we can do for him.
In the morning, their mom in Mexico gets a call from the smuggler with a different story. He tells her that Jose disappeared. He said he was going out to the store to get some juice and never came back.
Whatever happened, Jose ends up in U.S. custody near the border. We know that much. Then, 2 days later, on Monday morning, Rosario gets another call from her brother. He tells her he's been taken to the Eloy Detention Center, a few hours north in Arizona.
When he calls you, what did he sound like?
Emocionado, porque estaba de este lado, pero a la vez como ya ansioso de que ya lo sacaran.
She says he sounded excited to be in the U.S., but was anxious to get out of detention. She tells him, be patient, we're going to find a lawyer, and we're going to get you out.
Over the next 2 days, Gabriel and Rosario call the detention center several times, hoping to check up on their brother, but they're never able to speak with him. They're told that they have to first put money on an account for him, then wait a while, and then Jose can call them.
What they're not told is that he was acting bizarrely, or that he was seen by a psychiatrist, or that he was put on suicide watch.
According to the accounts of other detainees, Jose at this point is desperate to talk to his family. At the same time, all his family wants to do is to talk to him. But it doesn't happen.
The last time his siblings try to call is on Wednesday. The same afternoon, Jose dies.
Right after 5, and I call the detention center asking for my brother. And the guy goes like, oh, hold on. You can't talk to him right now. You gotta call back tomorrow between 7 to 3. The next morning, she had a call from the Mexican consul saying that they found my brother dead in his cell.
In shock, Gabriel and Rosario drive straight from Las Vegas to Tucson, where Jose's body is being held. They retrieve it and hold a wake in a local funeral home.
Seeing her brother lying in the coffin, Rosario was overcome. She says she leaned over the casket and spoke to him. What did they do to you, she said. Why didn't you defend yourself?
¿Por qué no te defendiste?
How come you didn't wait for me?
No me esperaste, le dije.
Forgive me, brother, for having failed you.
Dije, yo iba a venir por ti, pero no así, le dije. Le dije, perdóname por haberte fallado, hermano.
After hearing the story from the family, we didn't know what to think. On one hand, his behavior at the border sounds erratic. You know, he's running, he's panicked, he's yelling on the phone to his sister that the coyote wants to kill him. And remember, according to the documents reviewed by the medical examiner, he was acting strangely in detention a few days later. So it's possible that Jose de Jesus was having some kind of paranoid episode at the border. But on the other hand, it's totally plausible, given the realities of crossing the border, that somebody actually was trying to kill him. So maybe he was acting rationally, and U.S. authorities thought he was crazy when he was really just scared.
As for the events after he was in U.S. custody, the family has even less information. They just don't know much about what went on inside the Eloy Detention Center on the days leading up to his death.
We need the truth. We need to see the recording tapes. That's what we want.
The recording tapes Gabriel is talking about, surveillance footage he knows the medical examiner watched, is video that could have major clues as to what happened to Jose. But getting those tapes won't be so easy.
Technically, anybody can ask a government agency for things like documents or videos, and the government is supposed to try and fill those requests. And that's because of transparency laws. One of those laws is called the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA for short.
So in this case, we wrote up a few FOIAs. We asked ICE for all documents relating to Jose's case, video of his last day in detention, a list of staff working at Eloy at the time, and some other stuff. And then we waited.
Because usually these public record requests take a long time to fill.
And sometimes the government ends up either denying these requests or severely redacting what they give you, leaving reporters and families with unanswered questions.
And the lack of transparency is especially a problem for facilities that are run by private companies. You've probably heard of the private prison industry. For decades, the government has been contracting out correctional services, that is, the work of imprisoning people for criminal violations, to private companies, companies that staff and build and operate prisons. That's also true for immigrant detention, and they're the same companies doing both.
So immigrant detention is like prison in a lot of ways. When you arrive, you're strip searched, fingerprinted, given a uniform, and taken to a cell. But unlike prisons, the people inside are held because of immigration violations, which are not criminal charges. They haven't been found guilty in a courtroom or been given a sentence. Here's Grace Meng, a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch.
Because it's not like a criminal justice system, in some ways, it can be more traumatic. It is indefinite. There's no sentence. People have told me, if I knew when I was getting out, that would be one thing, but I don't know when I'm going to get out.
For some, detention lasts a couple of weeks. For others, it's months or even years.
I met a man a couple weeks ago who spent 9 years and 4 months in immigration detention fighting his case. And the psychological toll is enormous.
And what makes this more challenging is having to navigate this whole process without a lawyer.
Unlike in the criminal context, an individual who's in our custody is not entitled to free legal services.
That's Liz Cedillo Pereira. She's a senior advisor to the director of Immigration Customs Enforcement, or ICE. She said in an interview that people who are in their custody have to either hire someone to represent them, find a pro bono lawyer, or represent themselves.
These are civil immigration proceedings, not criminal proceedings, and therefore no constitutional right to counsel.
So immigrant detainees don't have many of the same rights as prisoners in the criminal system. That's maybe why so many of them end up staying in detention longer than they should.
And that year, ICE said more than 300,000 people went through the detention system.
It's a difficult thing to manage alone, and we depend on vendors who can provide the services that we need to accommodate all of those varying needs from the global population, which we hold in our custody.
Our destination, the best full-service adult correction system. Our vision is our motivation.
This is sound from a promotional video for one of those vendors, CCA, the Corrections Corporation of America, which runs the Eloy Detention Center.
CCA, which has since changed its name to Core Civic, is one of the largest private prison corporations running detention centers for ICE. The government spends somewhere between $70 and $120 a night for every detainee they hold.
Backing of 17,000 employees, we combine the accountability of government with the efficiency of business.
People in the detention centers sort of knew that Eloy was the worst of the worst.
This is Victoria Lopez. She's a lawyer for the ACLU in Phoenix and works a lot with immigrants in detention at Eloy.
Constant complaints about medical care, mental health care, being placed in segregation without knowing why or knowing when you'd get out.
We should mention that we requested an interview with CCA, but were denied that. Instead, CCA officials said that they would respond to some questions in writing, so we sent questions, but got no response.
Despite its reputation, Eloy has passed all of ICE's compliance tests that are supposed to make sure everything is going well and that the detention center is meeting basic standards.
Eloy is also the detention center that has had the most deaths. According to numbers from ICE, 15 people have died there since 2004, and 5 of those have been ruled suicides.
So you're on 10?
Yeah, 10 all the way basically.
10 south.
A few months after Jose's death, Marlon and I paid a visit to the Eloy Detention Center to get a sense of what it's like to be detained there.
The actual town of Eloy is about an hour outside of Phoenix, and basically it's a tiny company town for CCA. There are 3 CCA prisons in Eloy, in addition to the detention center, including one that holds almost all of the male prisoners from Hawaii. Yeah, if you're a man convicted of a crime in Hawaii, you might get put on a plane and flown to this little town in Arizona.
We arrive at the Eloy Immigrant Detention Center, enter through a large chain-link gate, and walk into a building where visitors are received.
After Jose's death, reporters were asking to come in and see what was going on, including us. And so, ICE arranged for us to take part in a press tour.
A very tightly controlled press tour.
Yes, the rules were strict. No talking with detainees, no photos of anyone above the waist, and no recording or quoting the comments of any government or CCA employee. Over the course of several hours, they lead us through the spaces typical of what you'd imagine in a high-security prison.
Drab, gray, cement buildings, 2 stories high, and fencing and razor wire everywhere.
They took us to the so-called tanks where detainees live.
Cement floor.
The rec yard.
A couple of basketball nets.
The chow hall.
Mush.
The commissary.
There's salt and pepper, McCormick, hot taco seasoning.
And what was really eerie about being there was looking at people's feet, because everyone was wearing identical thick orange socks. The same type Jose choked on.
And what was more striking was something that happened in the parking lot. We met a woman named Susie Morales. She was there to pick up her elderly grandmother, who was inside the detention center.
She's very old, my grandma, and She's diabetic, slightly going blind. That's why they decided to let her go, because they thought that someone with in that high an age, she shouldn't be here. It's just overwhelming. It's a place you don't want to see your grandma in, because you think the worst. You think that she's behind bars when she's never committed anything.
And that's the thing. For all intents and purposes, it's this intimidating prison. Yet looking around, I was really aware that the people I was seeing weren't violent criminals. I mean, yes, some do have criminal records. There's no doubt about that. But a lot of them don't. And so I couldn't help but think about Jose, who didn't have a criminal record, showed up at the border asking for help, and ended up here.
After the tour, we were allowed to interview two detainees briefly. They didn't witness Jose's death, so we didn't learn much from them. But before we left, we passed them a piece of paper with our phone numbers on it, and we asked them, if you hear of anyone that has any information about Jose, let us know.
So the tour ends, we go back home to New York, months go by, and then one day I get this text message. It was kind of a reporter's dream.
It just said, in Spanish, "My name is Juan Castillo Perez. I witnessed the death of José de Jesús Denis Sahagún. Please call me."
So right away, Fernanda and I called him.
Hello?
Coming up on Latino USA, we meet the man who sent us that mysterious text message. No te vayas. Welcome back to this special edition of Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa with producers Marlon Bishop and Fernanda Chavarri.
When we left off, we had just gotten a text message from an unknown number. It was a man named Juan Castillo Perez, saying he had witnessed the death of José de Jesús.
So right away, Fernanda and I call him.
Hello?
Hola, ¿qué tal? ¿Habla Juan Castillo?
Sí, a sus órdenes.
Juan tells us he was in the medical unit recovering from a broken leg in a room directly across from José.
Compartí, pues, el mismo espacio con el...
He since has been deported back to Mexico. He says he used to work as a police detective in central Mexico back in the day, and he kind of talks like a no-nonsense detective from an old movie.
Juan tells us that he was probably the last person to ever speak with José. He says a few hours before his death, José was escorted out of his locked room and taken to the shower. That's when the two of them briefly talked. Juan told José to cheer up because he had heard José make comments about wanting to die. So Juan told him to be careful with those thoughts, that he was young and that life was worth living.
And he says José responded with a sort of, "Don't worry, everything's cool." Juan says he was there when the guards noticed José was inside his cell and not responding.
He remembers hearing a guard call out José's name and bang on his door during one of the checkups. And after a few minutes, that guard called for help on the radio. That's when Juan and the other detainees were asked to go back in their cells.
Juan thinks that José should not have been taken off suicide watch.
If José had been monitored 24/7, he says, maybe he wouldn't have killed himself. And Juan tells us something else that we hadn't heard yet, that the guards responded too slowly, that they could have saved José.
Okay, so far in our reporting, we have a witness that says José could have been saved if the medical response was faster. We have detainee letters that claim that José was heard screaming and suggest that maybe he was mistreated inside the detention center. And we have the phone calls José made to his sister in the desert that paint a picture, an incomplete one, but a picture of what happened at the border.
But a question that still looms for us is, what was going on for him throughout all of this? If José had no history of mental illness, as his family has told us, how did he suddenly become suicidal? So we decided to take a trip to José's hometown in Mexico, where he was just 7 days before he died. We went in search of clues, and we ended up finding one.
Welcome to Manzanillo's Airport. For your information, local time is...
Jose's parents, Silverio and Elisa, live on a property they've managed for 30 years, on a remote beach on Mexico's west coast near Manzanillo. It's like a small motel with a pool in the middle and the Pacific Ocean as a backdrop.
Señora!
Jose's parents take us to his bedroom. There is an elliptical in the corner, a bed against the wall, and a dresser. And everything is just as it was the day Jose left.
The only thing that's changed is now there's an altar for Jose, where Silverio and Elisa come to pray. Sometimes with the help of a plastic electronic rosary.
Jose's 11-year-old nephew, Pepito, also lives here. And he says he used to spend a lot of time with his uncle playing video games in this room.
He thought of Jose as an older brother. He says his uncle was a little shy and would spend a lot of time in his room keeping to himself.
And actually, Pepito is the only one in the family who says Jose wasn't this happy, outgoing person like everyone else told us he was. Pepito says he was sad sometimes and that the only thing that seemed to cheer him up was talking to his kids on FaceTime. We follow the Denise Agun family on a 20-minute drive to a tiny cemetery with only a couple dozen other gravestones. The sun is about to set, and shortly after we get there, there's a large group of vultures circling over us. The family built a raised grave for Jose out of cement and tile, the kind you see in rural Mexico. They decorated it with a large cross held up by wooden posts. But all of that was destroyed by the most recent hurricane.
Standing over his grave, they refuse to believe Jose could have killed himself, both because the thought of their son doing that is unbearable, and also because they're devout Catholics.
Yo pienso que es el pecado más grande que comete uno en hacer ese daño.
The biggest sin one can commit is suicide, Silverio says, and there's no way my son could have done that.
No era para...
Before we leave, we ask if there's anyone else outside of the family that we can talk to who knew Jose, a doctor or maybe a priest.
And they give us a phone number for their family doctor. So we call him, and he says he actually treated Jose just months before he died, and that he's willing to talk to us about why Jose came to see him.
Soy Dr. Juan Manuel Aragón Morales, y tengo 41 años de ejercer en esta población la medicina.
Dr. Juan Manuel Aragón Morales has been treating people in this small town for 41 years. And in March of 2015, he remembers getting a call from Jose's parents.
Porque andaba muy triste, no quería hacer nada, andaba deprimido.
Silverio and Elisa brought Jose to Dr. Aragón. They told him that they noticed Jose was sad, he didn't want to do anything, and seemed depressed.
Un cuadro depresivo moderado.
The doctor asked Jose a few questions. He asked Jose if he had trouble sleeping, and he said yes. He asked if he had ever thought of ending his life, and Jose told the doctor he had.
Sentían ganas de quitarse la vida en ese tiempo, la primera consulta.
According to Dr. Aragón, Jose did not seem to be suffering from clinical depression. Instead, he had what the doctor called moderate situational depression. That's the sort of temporary depression that you might feel when somebody dies or after the end of a relationship. In this case, Jose was missing his kids terribly.
Él lo que más extrañaba era a sus hijos.
The doctor told Jose to take an over-the-counter antidepressant every night before going to bed.
Que se llama mirtazapina.
About 20 days later, the doctor saw Jose again. By then, he looked much better. He was more active, and the medication seemed to be working. A month after that, he saw him again, and there was even more improvement.
Dr. Aragón says that yes, Jose was emotionally more fragile than someone who hadn't suffered from depression. But he did not believe at the time that Jose was suicidal. He told Jose to continue taking the antidepressants and wait to get his papers sorted out before trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border to see his kids.
That would be the last time they saw each other.
We
just left the doctor's office and we walked down to a little restaurant.
So I have to say that the first words out of his mouth, me dejaron frías. I went cold. His parents brought him here because he was depressed.
After telling us 100 times that he was never depressed.
Part of what I'm thinking, and especially having grown up in Mexico, where any kind of mental illness, any kind of depression, it's not something that families talk about in Mexico. There is a lot of shame that comes with admitting to having any kind of problem like this. Yes, I'm shocked because the parents kept saying over and over that he didn't have any problems, but in some ways, I'm not surprised.
Yet they gave us the doctor's contact, knowing that the doctor knew something. Maybe it's that they wanted us to know, but they couldn't say the words themselves almost because it's so painful.
It's our last day in Mexico, and when we get back to our hotel, I check my email, and there's something from ICE. It says, final response to FOIA request.
This seems unusual because it's been only a month since we sent our request on Jose's case, and these things usually take a long time.
We're hoping these are the documents we requested, or maybe even the surveillance footage that we asked for. But it's neither. It's just a letter.
Dear Ms. Echavarri, this is the final response to your Freedom of Information Act request to U.S. immigration personnel, doctors, nurses, etc., who were on duty on May 20th, 2015.
Operations for records responsive to your request produced one Excel spreadsheet will be withheld in its entirety. Pursuant,
you have the right to appeal ICE's withholding determination. And that is all we got, which means we have been formally denied access to any video that ever existed from the day of the death of José de Jesús Denis Sahagún.
So we leave Mexico knowing more about who Jose was. We know that he had felt depressed and that he was taking antidepressants at the direction of his doctor.
But we don't know when he stopped taking the antidepressants. What we do know is that according to the autopsy, they were not in his system at the time he died.
So this question comes up. If he was already emotionally unstable, how did being detained affect his mental state?
We leave Mexico still searching for some documentation of what happened to Jose inside the detention center. Answers that perhaps could be in the reports and video that we were denied.
So we come back to New York City feeling like we're never going to get what we need.
Then, a week later, Fernanda gets a call.
It literally said on the caller ID, City of Eloy, all in caps. So I pick up the phone, and it's a woman that works for the local police department. Now let's pause for a second. Remember how earlier in the episode we talked about how we requested all this information and documents from ICE? That wasn't the only place where we went searching. And here's why. On the day Jose died, the detention center had to call 911. And in doing so, the local police department and paramedics had to show up, leaving a paper trail of what happened. So a few weeks back, we had requested all the documents regarding that incident from the small Eloy Police Department. And that's what this call was about. They had the documents ready to send via email.
And it is 48 pages.
Completely unredacted.
And honestly, this was really unexpected. All of a sudden, we had a much better picture of what happened the day Jose died.
The police department documents include first-person narratives from guards and medical staff who were there when Jose was found unresponsive.
Nobody said that when they walked in, they saw a sock in his mouth. They say, in fact, that he was having problems breathing.
That means that nobody reached into his mouth and tried to help him.
Right, because nobody saw a sock, according to these reports.
We also learned that Jose was still alive when the guards entered his cell. The first guard to enter used a protective shield, put it on Jose's back as he was face down, and then they handcuffed him before Jose received medical attention.
And even if that is procedure, to me, I mean, that tells me also something about the culture of a detention center. I mean, that is looking at people as criminal threats.
The documents reveal that on his first day at Eloy, Jose was with the general population. And at some point, guards say he was saying things like, "They're after me. They're gonna kill me." The exact same things he had said to his sister on the phone when he was at the border.
On the second day, there's an order from the psychiatrist to put him on suicide watch. And that means he's locked up by himself in a special cell, modified so that there's nothing he can hurt himself with. The order says he's not to have utensils, no bedding, and only a mattress on the floor. They take away his clothes and issue him a smock that can't be torn to create a noose, for example.
And there's another order from the same doctor a day later, on the third day. This one removes Jose from suicide watch and puts him on a 15-minute watch. He's still locked up by himself and not with the general population, but they give him back his normal uniform, including his socks, and they have a guard check on him every 15 minutes.
Through the documents, we find out that at the 5:30 check that evening, a guard found Jose lying on his stomach, not moving in his cell. Less than an hour later, he was pronounced dead.
Another thing we find is that there was a female guard who took a video.
It's a video that lasts 2 minutes and 53 seconds. And it is a video of basically the CPR that was being done on him and the last moments of Jose de Jesus' life inside the cell.
And the police department records say that a copy of that video was taken to their evidence room, along with copies of the surveillance video.
I requested that this morning, and we could get it.
We didn't know if getting copies of those videos would actually be possible. The local police department in the city of Eloy could deny our request.
Fast forward 3 weeks, and we get a manila envelope in the mail with a CD.
So I just ripped through this envelope, and we're going to see what is in the CD.
This is, like,
going to
be intense to watch.
Yeah, I mean, we should...
This is it. A handheld video. Taken by a guard at the exact moment guards and medical staff enter Jose's cell after they realize something is wrong.
Oh my God. All right, so okay. The first thing we see is actually just a stop frame of some feet, like looking like they're running.
Look at how long the video is. How long is it?
2:53.
Oh my God.
This is gonna be intense, people.
Next time, what happens in that video? How did the guards react? We hear more from what ICE officials have to say about the detention system. And a year after the death of Jose de Jesus, a report is released with details about what happens to him from the moment he arrives on the U.S. border. The report helps answer some of the most pressing questions about the strange death of Jose de Jesus. That's next time on Latino USA.